Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there, and welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies. I'm your host, Ian Cook, and today we're talking about rethinking classical Indo-Roman trade, the political economy of Eastern Mediterranean exchange relations. The book is published by Oxford University Press in 2016 and is written by Rajan Gurakal, professor at the Indian Institute of Sciences in Bangalore, India. The book casts a critical eye over the exchanges, usually and problematically termed trade, between the Eastern Mediterranean and coastal India in the classical period. Using insights from economic anthropology to recast the standard narrative of the time, the book explores the ports and polity in South India, as well as the different types of exchange relations in both the Eastern Mediterranean and the subcontinent. The book really is a fascinating, provocative, and insightful study, and I had the pleasure of speaking with Rajan just a few moments before. Okay, so it gives me great pleasure to welcome Rajan to New Books in South Asian Studies. Let's dive straight into the heart of your book. I was wondering, what has been the standard understanding of exchange relations between the Indian subcontinent and the classical Greco-Roman world? Why is this problematic, and how do you propose that we rethink it?
In Indian historiography, first, the problem starts with the term trade itself. It's taken as a universal term which is applicable to any period whatsoever. But we have rather profoundly enunciated level of knowledge in economic anthropology relating to forms of exchange, different forms of exchange. And trade is distinguished as that kind of exchange which used money both as means of payment and measure of value, whereas other forms did not. For example, the forms like gift, reciprocity, redistribution, and so on. Indian historiography never differentiated the history of trade in the context of the multiple forms of exchange. This is one major reason that prompted me to take up the issue. Another one, that there was always talk about Indo-Roman trade. At the same time, the exchange related to 1st century BCE to, say, 3rd century CE. The question naturally came, how could then it become Indo-Roman? Roman-Indian trade, even that expression would be inadequate in the sense. These were exchanges in which India as an entity, political entity, that did not exist at that time, did not involve. Whereas in the case of Rome, there was a huge Roman Empire there. And it was not the empire that was conducting exchange directly. These were run by various agencies like aristocrats and financiers and mariners and so on. Mostly Philistines, Greeks, Arabs and so on were the traders. But the Eastern Mediterranean exchange was by and large under the various facilities of the empire, which means the exchange took place between an empire and then a non-monetized kind of communities in South India. Therefore, I thought it should be exposed that the expression Indo-Roman is a misnomer, and that was the second aspect. A third one was that always there was this discussion that it was a big profit accumulating process in South India. A lot of gold came, and the Roman Senate became anxious about the drain of gold because they were buying a lot of pepper by spending money and so on. So where did this money really go, and how come that after the decline of the trade, South India still remained in its semi-tribal condition? That I had to clarify. That was the third reason. And fourth was I found it was unnecessary for Southern India to conduct trade. It was also impossible for Southern India to conduct trade in those times because their internal exchange did not indicate any sign of trade-based exchange. They were all based on redistribution and reciprocity and so on. And in Indian historiography, there have been claims about some of the South Indian chieftains themselves conducting overseas trade, and they're going all the way and so on. So that, in fact, encouraged me to ask the question, what is this trade that we are talking about? And then, I understood it was really a very hazardous kind of organization. It required a lot of institutional structural facilities, and it required a whole lot of protection from state power and so on, without which it could not have been possible. And then the basic economic thing was the demand. It required demand. And did in South India, develop any effective demand for goods produced in the Mediterranean world? And if you think from the side of the Mediterranean world was certainly interested in spices. And they came in their own vessels, and their interest was to cross the ocean and then ship as much as possible spices and then distribute it all over the Europe. So their interest was real trade interest. That kind of technology did not exist in South India. And it was not possible because they were all in pre-state society situations. And it was not possible, and also it was not necessary either. They were not in that level of material culture necessitating the sophisticated products of the Mediterranean world. In these contexts, I thought a revisiting of the whole source material was necessary, and a total revamping of the whole existing ideas, and that accounted for my writing of Rethinking Indo-Roman Trade. Yeah.
That's wonderful. That gives us a great summary of the impetus behind the book. I want to talk a little bit about some of the individual chapters in the book, but before we do that, I was wondering, for those who are unfamiliar with your past work, could you tell us how your previous research interests led into this current project?
Yes. I actually studied the socio-economic and political system of early South India, say from 2nd century BC up to 8th century AD or CE. As part of that study, it was important for me to characterize the social formation of the turn of the Christian era or common era. And then I understood that the society was a combination of multiple forms of exchange, but structured by the dominance of agropastoralism. And I studied the internal exchange pattern studied the redistributive economy. And then incidentally, the question of Eastern Mediterranean contacts came in, because it was during that period the Greco-Roman traders came and they conducted brisk exchange in spices. And there I noticed that the Greco-Roman exchange was not able to impact the economy of the period, an economy which was largely predatory in nature and redistributive in its operation, and a chiefdom level society. Such a society or socio-economic system was not seriously affected by the Greco-Roman exchanges. So there I just noted that it was not correct to identify that as a phase of big maritime civilization, as earlier historians thought. In South Indian historiography, we find early historians talking about the period between, say, 1st century, 2nd century BCE and 3rd century CE as period of maritime civilization. That expression I treated as misnomer, and I just left it there. Then after some time, what I developed only in the form of a paragraph was developed in the form of an essay, and I published it in Economic and Political Weekly. And then I developed it further and published in Indian Historical Review. And in the process, then I started thinking about the whole thing that it was necessary to do it in an extensive way to convince people, because people were rather treating my articles almost as expositions of matters of opinion. Mm-hmm. Then I thought it was necessary to discuss the whole thing in the light of the source material and also explain why even European writers on Indo-Roman exchange were not able to discuss it critically and so on. Led me to do the book.
Wonderful. So let's get some details then. Like as you said, these details are important for making your argument. I was wondering, could you broadly tell us what sort of exchange relations existed both in the Eastern Mediterranean and South India, Peninsula India at this time?
Yeah. Now we have the Greco-Roman writings and then the Tamil heroic poems, which refer to some of the context and aspects of exchange relations. What we hear from the Greco-Roman writings is about the traders from the Eastern Mediterranean world coming in their own ships in search of the spices, and they were the ones who could cross the Indian Ocean for the first time. They came in huge hulled ships and came with a lot of provisions to spend their time at least four to five months ashore. They came depending on monsoon winds, and they had to wait at least 4 to 5 months to get the return wind. In that sense, it was just an enterprise from their side. Now, from the Greco-Roman accounts, if we get a picture of the traders coming from the Eastern Mediterranean for the goods of their choice, in Tamil heroic poems, what we find is the coming of the big ships with gold and going with pepper. This is one passage. Another is that reference to the Western Sea as the Sea of the Chera rulers, and the sea itself was referred to as the sea of gold-giving ships. That's the reference. And several such passages are there. Now, some of these Tamil passages were interpreted by historians as enough evidence for arguing that the chieftains were able to navigate and bring gold and so on. So I examined the thing in the light of economic anthropology, or used the insights in economic anthropology, and found out that it was not possible for South Indian economy, political economically, to conduct the trade, and there was no need for it. The local society did not require any of the products from the Eastern Mediterranean world, and there was no demand for it. And otherwise, the demand-driven society was coming in their vessels, and then they were taking. So it involved a lot of adventurous things. Like, one is the cross-oceanic travel. It required excellent sail technology and also huge ships, which did not exist in India at that time. And they had to go all the way up to Athens and then into the Red Sea, and from there, from Berenike to Koptos through desert, and then travel through Nile. And it involved a lot of functions and services. And who could have mobilized such thing? That was my question. A huge empire was there to provide various facilities for this. And it was possible for the traders of Eastern Mediterranean world, and their interest was mainly to ship as much resources as possible, natural resources as possible, from the west coast, and then get it distributed with maximum difference between price and cost. So it's a heavily profitable enterprise for them. That picture was quite clear, but a similar kind of political economy did not exist in the case of southern India. Therefore, I used the a Tamil heroic poem cited even by Western writers as evidence for the flourishing commerce in southern India. In my re-examination of the source material, I found that many of the ideas attributed to these passages do not hold good. Their literal meaning is different, and the connotated meaning is also different. And that way, I experienced the vanishing of the so-called basis of primary source for the arguments. And that, in fact, encouraged me to go further to talk about the details of exchange and so on.
Thank you. Let's stick a little bit with the South Indian situation. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the ports at this period. Like, what was their function? What was their nature? How did they relate to levels of urbanization and so on?
Yes. And again, in Indian historiography, we find all the ports mentioned as urban centers. Now, I had a close examination of the archaeology of it, and I found out that most of the celebrated ports were mere ferries. They were not having bay for allowing big ships in, and there were no facilities for big ships to get anchored. The most celebrated port, Muziris, was on the mouth of a river, and no ship could enter that. A ship had to get anchored offshore, and in small boats they had to bring goods to the shore. And these were goods for their own. Certain other items were there, of course, but mostly they brought their wine, their fish fat and various thing, and also their utensils, etc., because they had to camp in a place. And such camps were part of every port. And we have archaeological evidence at Arikamedu on the east coast, and recently at Patanam, which is most probably Mussoorie of the time. In all these places, we find a lot of Eastern Mediterranean ceramics and allied goods showing the presence of the Greek or Roman and generally the Eastern Mediterraneans in these places. Early historians thought that these were all part of imports. Mortimer Wheeler, of course, rightly pointed out that Arecomedo was a Roman colony. The Romans camped there. And these are Roman material and so on. And this was questioned by the so-called nationalist writers, saying that the colonial perspective is Eurocentric perspective. It should be questioned and so on. And they ruled out the colonizing thing or Roman colony question. Instead, they said these were all part of the import of the time. Now, I argue that import and export are utterly anachronistic in the present day context if you examine ancient exchanges. State was not involved in that, and there was no question of talking about these concepts in neoclassical economics. Neoclassical economics doesn't have any role. One has to go by the insights in economic anthropology. This is not to say that value was not there. Certainly value was part of the exchange, but it was not profit. There was no notion of exchange value as such, no price as such. But at the same time, certainly they had their notions of value. Now, if you take into account the presence of Greco-Roman material in ports, you find that these were all articles used by them. Now, my argument is that there is no single instance to show the penetration of these ceramics into the interior. If one has to prove the import, then all important centers should yield relics of this. That means people were consuming. And they talk about import of wine and so on, but this should not be treated as import of wine. It's bringing wine for the use of Eastern Mediterraneans. That happened to be part of their dietary item, so they brought it. They brought their vessels and their tablewares and so on. We don't find such highly sophisticated Mediterranean ceramics going into the interior, or even people imitating that kind of thing. This is another indication. If you have a local imitation, then that shows cultural communication that happened through the artifacts, and people themselves started using it, maybe as an indicator of status, ranking, and so on. But nothing of that sort is seen. Perhaps a few chieftains must have been given gifts of wine. Other than that, I don't think any of the ruling personages of the time cultivated the practice of drinking wine because of the contact and so on. So the two arguments, one, the port town of the period was a big urban center, and then a big harbor. These two are not supported by evidence. And it also has to be connected to the overall socio-economic situation, political economy and so on, where all these are not in harmony with this. It's not logical to think about it. So I have characterized them all as ferries where Eastern Mediterranean traders had to camp because they had to wait until the return wind starts blowing. And to cater to their needs, some people also converged. And a lot of traders from the other parts of India, the northern part of India, they also had come with their Himalayan products and products even from Southeast Asia and so on. It was not possible for the Greco-Roman merchants to travel all the way to the Southeast Asian regions and so on, which the Arabs did. So Arabs certainly might have brought. the Eastern Mediterranean merchants traveled only up to, at the most, Arica Medu in the west coast. Beyond Chennai region, they did not move. But all other overland merchants, long-distance itinerants, had brought their goods. And in that sense, every ferry could be a seasonal camp looking like a fair place with a lot of people from different cultures interacting, and some of them doing higgling and haggling, goods for goods exchange, others in a very formal way exchanging bulk of goods and so on. And then the ships went back. That kind of a situation has to be conceived. And I therefore characterized a port of the, it need not be southern India alone, a port of even upper northwestern India as just a ferry place, a fair place, which was not urbanized. For having a proper urban center, one should require a hinterland production center. That economic link between a hinterland and then the a port town cannot be established. There is no local base for any of the ports of the time. So I dismiss the idea that port was a big harbor and an urban complex. And also, I don't think that it was economically supported by the local populace.
Thank you so much. So it's one of the things we've skirted around in the conversation so far is the nature of the state or the polity that existed in South India. Yeah. And this, I mean, you've talked about chieftains and so on, and yes, and how what existed in South India was most probably very different from the Roman world at the time. Yeah. So I was wondering, could you tell us, like, what was the nature of the polity in South India, and how did this affect exchange both overland and also overseas?
The chieftains of southern India during the period were basically hunter chieftains. Mm-hmm. And they emerged out of agropastoral economy. And we have the whole corpus of Tamil heroic poems celebrating chieftains as big predatory chieftains. Their economy was of insufficiency, and they compensated the insufficiency of the economy by organizing campaigns of predatory operation. They invaded the agricultural areas and amassed the produce and then redistributed that. And so it was a predatory operation, or it was politics of plunder that maintained them in power. But this could not go beyond a point. And some of the bards coming from northern India seem to be advising these chieftains to be systematic about appropriation of resources from people and so on, asking them to learn from what butterflies do. Butterflies go around taking honey from flowers, and they don't destroy the flower. Whereas a chieftain is invading a place and plundering the resources, and that, according to the poets, was almost like an elephant entering the sugarcane field. But such pieces of advice were whispering at the ears of the chieftains. They are called Cheviarivuru Turai. This was something which a poet whispered at the ear of the chieftain secretly. In public, it was not possible because the passions and values revolved around heroism, plunder, redistribution, and so on. But at the same time, some of these poets who had experience with the state systems in northern India, they thought that chieftains should not be behaving like this. They had knowledge about periodic exaction, or what is called taxation. And instead of this plunder-based accumulation of wealth and then redistribution, turned out to be something not sustainable according to them. Therefore, they were trying to advise the chieftains. Now, I take this as an indicator of the character of the polity of the period. So I characterize the whole polity as the polity of chiefdom level. Although in conventional historiography, we find historians talking about big kings, this, that, and so on. But these were not really kings. These were chieftains. And different levels of chiefdom could be seen there. A village level chieftain, and then intermediary level chieftain, and then the bigger chieftain. So small and big chieftains were there, and some three big chieftains were there, and their chiefdoms, the Chera, Chola, and Pandya. And these were called the Movender, or the three big ruling lineages. And I tried to examine their features. And I found out that even these higher lineages had not become accomplished dynasties during the period, and they couldn't be treated as a representative of the state systems.
Thank you so much. It's an absolutely fascinating book. I really enjoyed reading it and talking with you about it today. I suppose that now that this book is out, you have new projects on the horizon. So I was wondering, can you tell us what you're working on now? What are your future plans?
Currently, I am visiting professor in Indian Institute of Science, where I teach history of science, philosophy of science, and things like that. And also, I have a current project on history and theory of knowledge, wherein my present book, the manuscript is with the publisher now. It's on history of knowledge production in pre-modern India. This has, again, as in the case of my earlier study, a certain compulsion. The compulsion is that today you hear a lot about the ancient sages of India producing higher knowledge in a magical way, or making God appear before them and provide them higher knowledge and so on. But at the same time, you have a large number of texts dealing with techniques of making knowledge reliable. Texts relating to skepticism, almost like the European skepticism of the later period. Even author himself becoming skeptical about the knowledge produced by him or her. And you find a lot of texts clearly indicating methodological preoccupation in the process of production of knowledge. Mm-hmm. This is a major contradiction. And even knowledgeable people today go about believing that sages were responsible for production of knowledge, and that they got as part of intuition or a divine providential gift. I wanted to question this. So my focus in the book is basically on the actual intellectual process of production of knowledge on one side, and then the socioeconomics of intellectual formation. Now, who were the ones who got leisure to think seriously, probe in depth, and then produce knowledge? And what were the compulsions behind the pedagogic exercises for codifying knowledge? Communities generated knowledge, they shared it, they inherited it, and they always expressed knowledge in the form of artifacts and products. But you find several texts written. So I asked the question, who were the composers of these texts? And what was the purpose? And I deal with the question of pedagogy there. And also, I try to identify certain problems in this. You find texts not having the actual craft of production of various artifacts. The craftsmanship remained with the artisans and craftsmen, and that knowledge is not in the text. And now if you use science to analyze, you generate science on the basis of scientific knowledge, which is taking science back to the object. And I found a hiatus there, that there is hiatus between the knowledge that existed during the period and then the knowledge that you take to the source. So it's important to take knowledge from the object rather than take your modern knowledge to the object and attribute that to people. An excellent case is that of metallurgy. Modern metallurgy will help you understand the ingredients of a heightened bronze of ancient period. But that doesn't mean that people had the same kind of metallurgical knowledge that we do today in the past. But they knew the craft of doing it. They had various subtle indicators and so on. They never thought about precise measurements or anything, or the melting point of this metal or the alloy. But they knew how to do it. See, this craftsman knowledge is rather lost. And how to retrieve this non-codified knowledge, which is there in the craft of doing, and they never asked the question how it worked, but they asked the question what it meant to them as procedure. So they had procedural knowledge, but not explanatory knowledge. So explanatory knowledge or science that we deal with today will not help us reconstruct the knowledge from the objects, which we think that embedded knowledge in the objects would be equal to the science that we have generated.
Absolutely fascinating. I look forward to reading that. You know, when it will come out, this year or next year?
Yeah, it's in the review process. I think in 6-7 months. Absolutely. It will be out.
Wonderful. Yeah. Well, there's not much more for me to do apart from to thank you a lot for coming on New Books in South Asian Studies.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for downloading the New Books in South Asian Studies podcast. I've been your host, Ian Cook, and today we've been talking about Rethinking Classical Indo-Roman Trade by Rajan Gudakal. I hope you enjoyed listening to the conversation as much as I did having it, and I hope you listen again next time. Ta-ra!